In part two of my observation of common errors, I'd like to address a few thoughts about 12-lead interpretation. As was the case for arrhythmia interpretation, some organized system for interpreting 12-lead ECGs is needed, in which you look at the same parameters in the identical sequence each time you interpret an ECG. Too many clinicians commit the error of failing to appreciate that there are two, not one, but two steps in optimal time-efficient 12-lead ECG interpretation. I call these two steps descriptive analysis and the clinical impression. The first step, which is descriptive analysis, is easy because it is routine. You simply go through your system without, and I'll emphasize without yet contemplating what your findings might mean. The six parameters I use for my systematic approach to descriptive analysis are rate and rhythm, as we've already discussed, intervals, looking at the three 12-lead intervals, which are the PR, QRS, and QTC intervals, axis, chamber enlargement, and then assessment of QRST changes with attention to ischemia and infarction. Rate, rhythm, intervals, axis, chamber enlargement, and QRST changes, in which I look in all 12 leads for Q waves, R wave progression, and ST segment and T wave changes. Even after interpreting a few million tracings, I find that when I skip any of these sequential steps in my system, that I overlook findings because I wasn't systematic. The fun part of interpretation comes now. After you've assessed the ECG for rate, rhythm, intervals, then axis, hypertrophy, and QRST changes, now is the time to clinically apply what you have observed to the clinical case at hand. If the patient in question is an otherwise healthy young adult who needed an ECG as part of his or her pre-participation physical exam, then some type of repolarization variant will be a far more likely explanation for tall peak T waves than if you saw the identical ECG in the emergency department, obtained from an older adult with new chest pain, in which case we'd be concerned about hyperacute T waves signaling a possible early infarction. So the error is the failure to appreciate that the identical ECG with the identical descriptive analysis may lend itself to a dramatically different clinical interpretation depending on the history. You cannot optimally interpret an ECG in the absence of a brief, relevant clinical history. And the error that I so commonly see is the failure to give adequate attention to the clinical history. A related error, similar to the situation I described earlier when applying the systematic approach to rhythm analysis, is the tendency to gravitate to an all-or-none diagnosis, especially with the diagnosis of an acute STEMI, ST elevation myocardial infarction. At least 25 to 30% of all acute coronary occlusions will be missed if providers get stuck on a millimeter-dependent diagnosis for a STEMI, and if these providers fail to activate the cath lab unless and until strict STEMI criteria are reached. Additional related errors to the situation are several. One, the failure to appreciate that in a patient with new-onset chest pain, T waves that are taller than expected, given the size of the R wave or S wave in that lead, but taller than expected, fatter at their peak, and wider at their base than expected, these T waves should be assumed hyperacute until proven otherwise. Two, once you find one or two leads with definitely abnormal ST-T wave changes, less obvious but still abnormal changes in neighboring leads are also probably abnormal. Three, the more leads on a 12-lead tracing in a patient with chest pain that are abnormal, the more concern we need to have for an acutely evolving cardiac event regardless of whether millimeter criteria for a STEMI are satisfied. Remember, at least 25 to 30% of all OMIs, that is, occlusion-based myocardial infarctions, can be diagnosed on ECG despite not satisfying the number of millimeters of ST elevation required to qualify as a STEMI. The cath lab should be activated for such patients, and in fact, current guidelines state that persistent chest pain with ECG changes suspicious for acute ischemia, even in the absence of a definite STEMI, is indication for prompt cardiac cath to define the anatomy for potential reperfusion. Failure to appreciate the concept of an OMI with resultant delay in the wait for STEMI criteria to be fulfilled is a potentially lethal error. The final error I'll mention regarding the interpretation of 12-lead ECGs relates to the one time in which I do abort my systematic approach in the middle of my assessment. This is when, in the process of assessing a supraventricular rhythm, you discover that the QRS complex is wide, so the rhythm is not VT, and you've completed assessment of rate and rhythm, and while assessing intervals, you note that the QRS complex is wide. stop your systematic approach at this point. Before proceeding, determine why the QRS is wide. If you've determined that the rhythm is supraventricular and the QRS is wide, assuming you are not dealing with WPW, there are only three possible reasons for QRS widening, which are right bundle branch block, left bundle branch block, or IVCD, which stands for an intraventricular conduction defect not due to either right or left bundle branch block. The reason I stress not worrying about axis, hypertrophy, or QRST changes of infarction ischemia until you determine why the QRS is wide is because the criteria to use for determining axis, hypertrophy, and ischemia infarction-related changes are different when you have bundle branch block or IVCD. So after you determine the type of conduction defect, be it right bundle branch block, left bundle branch block, or IVCD, then continue with your systematic approach, armed with the knowledge that criteria for axis, hypertrophy, and ischemia infarction will need to be modified accordingly.